straight bullpen, then you can make the argument and say, well, what's different from their staff of the past 2 years, what the Royals have done? Because it's fairly similar as far as pitching staffs, except for bullpen. Bullpen is huge in Kansas City, and I don't think the Red Sox have it.
And as good as their young players are, and they're very good, who knows what they're going to do in a pennant race if they're in one, which I don't believe they're going to be.
I'm right there with you. I think it's a two-team race, and you know, if Tulo stays healthy in that lineup, and I think Pilar has got breakout potential in center field. I think there's a lot of pop there, obviously, in that lineup. If they get any pitching, and Stroman's coming back this year, you get anything out of the number three and four starters there, and Sanchez is starting now, the number five. Toronto and the Yankees to me seem like that's a battle right there. Baltimore's gonna win a lot of games, but they're gonna lose a lot. They've got a decent bullpen, but their pitching is just like Boston. It's atrocious.
And if Tulo stays healthy, that team's going to hit it like a softball team all year again.
Yep.
You know, they probably don't need him to, but if he has a healthy year, they may have an offensive year like no one's ever seen and still probably won't win in the postseason because you just don't win in the postseason scoring all your runs hitting bombs.
Yep, no question. So feel free to disagree. We love that, like back in the day, Will Trum and myself here getting on here and totally disagreeing, almost like a 180 approach here. What up, dude? Some of the predictions there that I threw out earlier. Do you agree? Am I way off? Do you see no shot, Dick Vitale, in Carrasco, Archer being top five pitchers in the AL?
Well, I'll disagree with two things you said, and I'll give you the reason. I don't believe Archer will have a huge year. I don't believe J.D. Martinez will have a huge year, because I just got finished drafting both of those two in my redraft league, which means they're either going to stink or they're going to be in the back of an ambulance.
Oh, man. Whew. Oh, all right. Well, at least there's an asterisk there. Clones predictions. Would have been, should have, could have, would have. But
yeah,
Vino drafted them.
They probably would have been right, but I've messed you up on at least those two, Clone.
All right, buddy. All right, Bino. Well,
chime in much, but I'm always out here. I hate for my old tame ass to come on your show. I kind of feel like Pat Boone at
oh, man.
Out there at Woodstock. It's a great show. I love it.
I love you, Bino, man. I'll listen tomorrow as well, 11 to 1. Back on 1180, guys. Beanstar, the Bino, the Beanstar, rather. Bino, I appreciate you, man, and good luck in your and I think Bino brings a great point. I think a lot of people are talking. You know what? I think a lot of folks think that Red Sox team's just gonna, you know, like best record in the American League. They're gonna win I'm not buying it. I think they're building something really nice there, but I think it's probably 2 years. And, you know, that's if David Price doesn't out, you know, there is an out in his contract after, 16. So who knows? But, we do got to get out of here as, I went over a little bit. I apologize, to all, and, Tony's ready to get me out of here too, I'm sure. So, let's do it next week. And, opening day right around the corner, Final Four. Hey, let's hope for a Oklahoma. God, I'd even take a Villanova, or I will not root for Syracuse, whoever wins that other matchup, I will definitely pull for Villanova, Oklahoma, and probably won't even tune in, on Monday night. I'm not going to stay up that late. Anyways, come back next week. We'll catch you guys next week. Thanks for all the calls, listeners, Twitter followers. Give us a follow. Tell someone about it at BB Clone. And, again, tune in tomorrow, 11 to 1, 1180. Tony Basilio and Bino, Briny Boy, they'll be bringing it to you strong right there on 1180, 11 to 1 in the midday. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Really excited to bring you our next guest, because our next guest illuminated something that's near and dear to my heart and really shined a light on, I think, some underrated heroes in the history of rock and roll. And I didn't just say Southern rock, I said rock and roll. Mark Hrabowski's now joining. He is the author of Whiskey Bottles and Brand New Cars, The Fast Life and Sudden Death of Leonard. Really excited to bring you our next guest, because our next guest illuminated something that's near and dear to my heart and really shined a light on, I think, some underrated heroes in the history of rock and roll. And I didn't just say Southern rock, I said rock and roll. Mark Hrabowski's now joining. He is the author of Whiskey Bottles and Brand New Cars, The Fast Life and Sudden Death of Lynyrd Skynyrd. And Mark, I welcome you in. You also wrote a biography several years ago on Tom Landry that I loved and couldn't put down. I want to acknowledge that to you. And it is just so great to talk with somebody that's as gifted as you are. Man, I'm honored to have you today on Book Corner. Welcome in.
I don't know what to say. Thanks. Writing about these people, that's my life. Because I sort of almost transform myself into these people. It's the only way I can relieve my own mundane life. You know what I'm saying?
I can relate to that. A wise man once told me one time, Dick Schaap. As he
Go Bulldogs! Welcome, Knoxville, to the new Yahoo Sports Radio 1180.
You've been all around the world. You've dined with kings and queens, yet you keep coming back to the sports world. How do you do it? And he said, listen, every person that you visit with is going to have a story. I don't care who they are. And he said, some of the best stories I ever worked on were high school student athletes. And it got me thinking. And I'm just considering everything that Ronnie Van Zant was before they were quote-unquote discovered. And there was nothing in his past or lineage that said, this guy's going to be a rock and roll star, was there?
No, and if you think about it, you could probably say that about anybody who ever rose to that level of intellect and wisdom in music. They usually are judged as failures. This is almost like a constant theme when people talk about their childhood. Ronnie was a dropout. Hank Williams, who I'm writing a book about now, was a dropout in the 11th grade. These people were judged as losers, as failures. They'll never amount to anything. And this is also a common thing. Ronnie's own father thought he would be a failure. I have a book out now about Otis Redding, which is also in that southern genre on the soul side, the R&B side. And his father was a minister, could not tolerate Otis singing that kind of race music, you know, non-religious music. But these people had to find their own way in life. And they did it through music, which is an unbelievably common thread when you look at some of the most talented people we've ever seen in this generation.
Ronnie's really underrated. And yeah. The band around him, they were incredible players. I love playing music myself. I play guitar for a couple decades plus. What I appreciate about Skynyrd is the more time you spend with their music, the more you realize how much was there. And you talk about Ronnie Van Zant as a lyricist. It's mind-boggling to consider how Sweet Home Alabama, you write a lot about in the middle of the book.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, it's a song that different sides of that issue project, this is what he's saying. No, this is what he's saying. No, this is what he's saying. That is some brilliant writing that he did. And, you know, the truth is, he didn't stay at the party long enough to tell us what he was saying.
Maybe we should give him credit for that. Maybe that was sort of like a hidden agenda. Like, if I keep people guessing about what I really mean in the song, they'll buy it on both sides of the political divide. Because now, even to this day, you have raging arguments over whether that's a right-wing song or a left-wing song. And Ronnie, who was neither, really, he was apolitical. It came from whatever he was feeling at the moment. And what he was feeling at the moment was he had to defend Southern manhood from Neil Young, the Canadian interloper who besmirched the honor of the Confederacy and the post-Confederacy and Southern manhood by writing Southern Man in Alabama. That was his impulse to write the song. But what came out of it, I agree with you, it's just so oblique. It's fascinating to try to analyze that song because Ronnie never probably put a second of analyzing into it when he wrote it. Ed King told me that. Ed, the guitarist at the time, was Skynyrd, who came up with that great lick, you know, the opening lick, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, that was Ed King. He wrote it with Ronnie. He said as soon as Ronnie heard the lick, he had almost a complete song in his head. Could you believe that? A song like Sweet Home Alabama, which said so many things to so many different people. But that's how Ronnie was. It was organic. It would just spring up. It would be like an atom bomb exploding in his head. And another thing to remember is, he never wrote down a single word of any of his songs on paper. He would come into the studio, it would all be in his head. And he would know exactly how he'd want the arrangement to sound when he started singing. You know, I've written about a lot of people in music. I may have a book coming out on James Taylor next year even, another brilliant songwriter. Nobody has ever done it the way Ronnie Van Zant did. I'm still trying to figure it out myself.
I'll make sure I understand that now. So yeah. They walk into a studio.
All in his head.
big wheels keep on rolling. Carry me home to see my kin. Are you kidding?
All on his head. Ed King, who came from, you know, the Strawberry Alarm Clock, Incense and Peppermints, one of the most wordy songs written of all time, one of the most verbose, pretentious songs of the psychedelic rock era, helped to write that song. He comes into this situation now where he's with a guy who doesn't even have a pen and paper, and he has the thoughts all in his head. He knows what he wants. He sings it back to Ed so that he could get the complete arrangement. They go into the studio in Doraville, Georgia, with Al Cooper, great producer, who worked with Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones, and they're all flabbergasted that Ronnie has it all in his head. He could come in, he could run it down for them, they could get the sound levels, but it would all be in his head. And if it didn't sound right to him, he wouldn't do it. Otis Redding was that way too, by the way. When he'd go to Memphis, to Stax, to do some of those great soul hits, those songs were all in his head. Something like a pattern here with certain people being able to keep all these songs in their head and know exactly what they want to do with it.
In preparing for today, and I read your book cover to cover, anytime I'm going to talk to somebody, I think it's disrespectful. And I think authors can tell, because I've had several authors tell me, I can tell you read my book. Not only do I read the book, I like to look around and see what people are saying about the book. And then I also like to see if there are any other interviews out there. I noticed where you had said, people, I think, musically, they want to try and divide music. I think it's something that we all do. This is this genre, this is this. Hey, great music's great music. And we were talking before about some great soul and some things that you have a heart for and a love for. And speaking of Otis, you said when somebody asked you about Ronnie and some other contemporaries of Southern rock, you said, whoa, wait a second. He's closer to Otis than he is some of these other people that you think I'm going to name. Unpack that for me. Why do you feel that that's the case?
He was of a generation in North Florida that was in great transition in the 60s. They weren't like their fathers and their grandfathers. He's nothing like his father, Lacey, the truck-driving man who he wrote about, a hard-working man but never had a really an original creative thought in his head. Ronnie was of that generation in the 60s where all that was changing, where you could be a free thinker. You wouldn't have to think like your parents. And in Jacksonville at that time, again, in the throes of Jim Crow society, you know, very few blacks around, Ronnie was a great fan of soul music. You could hear it on the radio coming from Georgia, far end of the dial, the soul stations coming from Georgia. And he was a fan of Otis Redding. That was the music of the region. Muscle Shoals was like the mecca to these guys in Jacksonville. And Muscle Shoals was where all those Stax Volt records, you know, Wilson Pickett and Sammy Davis and Aretha Franklin. That's where that music was made. It must have been going to Mecca when Skinner's first recordings were made at Muscle Shoals. They weren't successful, but if you listen to them now, you hear the germination of this great band. They were coming together. They were very young and they were unfocused, but they still sort of knew what they wanted to do. So he had this love of soul music mixed in with his heritage, the music of his heritage. This is the old Confederacy we're talking about, which is being paved over by super highways and strip malls, and very little of that old Southern pride was left. So there was a whole different stream of impulses and thoughts and what he wanted to do with this music. And that's why it's so universal. They loved him in Japan. They got it in Japan. They got it in England. They got it in France. It was that universal. And if you listen to it, it is a distillation of a lot of different influences from Hank Williams, from Merle Haggard. They covered Merle Haggard. They covered J.J. Cale. They were doing all these different things, but they still had time to do blues music. That's why Stephen Gaines came in later on. Ronnie loved him because he was a blues guitarist and a blues singer. So there's all these different forces going on in Skinner that people really didn't realize. They were anything but a redneck band. That's way, way too simple an explanation for what they were doing.
That's the thing that your work illuminated and why I couldn't put it down. Because the more I learned about Ronnie Van Zant young, early on, he was a fighter, pugnacious, would beat anybody up for looking at him crossways, cocky, arrogant. And he basically drugged these untrained musicians on a ride around the world with him. Through his will, his passion, his determination. You're talking about just a real, to use his term, a real to the world, simple man who yeah. was never intimidated, was he? It didn't matter what situation that guy was in, he was never intimidated.
He was a simple man on a lot of levels, too, sort of like a backwoods intellectual. He was, but he always had that ballast. He always had that foundation of the Southern man and kin and God and family and moonshine and Saturday night dances and things like that. That was the heritage he came from, and he wasn't going to renounce it. There were great Southern bands, too. I mean, the Allman Brothers and Alabama and 38 Special with Roddy's brother, Donnie, Molly Hatchet, the Outlaws, Charlie Daniels. They all did something a little bit different than the other one. I don't think we've ever seen this. Writing about James Taylor, I got into that early 70s Southern California country rock culture. Sorry to say, I mean, it was great music, but there was a lot of it sounded exactly alike. People will disagree with me, obviously, if they want, if they feel that way, but that's my opinion. But when you look at the actual Southern rock, the actual country rock, the Dixie kind of hardcore Southern rock, I don't think any of those bands could be called similar, do you? At the beginning, when a lot of people were trying to reject Skinner, they would say, well, they sound too much like the Allman Brothers. They didn't sound anything at all like the Allman Brothers. The Allman Brothers would go off on 20-minute blues jams without a vocal, and they'd be great at it. And here's Skinner with 3-minute rock operas about the backwoods of the South. They were nothing alike. I think that's why that music stands up so well today. It's because everybody had something to say. I made the case in the book that the Southern songwriters were sort of the baby boomer carryover of the great literary set of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. You know, they were the new Fitzgeralds. They were the new Tennessee Williamses. They had something to say. And I don't think any part of the country, any region of the country can stand even close to the South when it comes to creating art from the heart and soul. The South stands by itself. And I only wish that they would realize it down there. I really do, because I don't think a lot of people do. They have a chip on their shoulder, and they always will for some reason. The weird dynamic.
Doesn't art, and you've studied a lot of great songwriters, that muse and where it comes from, pain, strife,
yeah, oh yeah,
difficulty, depression, joblessness, a lot of those things that probably would have defined Jacksonville in that time of transition, late 60s, early 70s, losing the heritage, so to speak. Don't you think that was reflective in their music? And then part two, they were really soulful. That's what you helped me to see. Not only yeah. the soulful background, but Ronnie had a soulful bent. And now when I go back and whether it's the early stuff or it's the I Know a Little later on, there's just a lot of great soul in their music.
Oh, definitely. This is something you could say about all American, Native American music, that it really started to become an identifiable property when the great Delta blues musicians started leaving the South and coming north, the Robert Johnsons, the Muddy Waters. When they started leaving the South and coming to Chicago and St. Louis and then fanning out to both coasts, the people that Alan Lomax would write about and go to prison to interview, like Lead Belly, when those guys started making their music heard was when American music matured. Matured from the folk idiom that developed in the 1800s when the immigrants came over from Europe. And it just developed in the mountains and the backwoods and in the Delta. And this is the music that really led to Skinner. Because, again, Ronnie loved rock and roll. He was a great Stones fan. Paul Rogers of Bad Company was his hero, his guitar hero, so to speak. But when he sat down and wrote, he couldn't help but integrate what he'd heard as a child from those great Delta blues musicians. And I could hear it. You could hear it, right? I mean, you could hear it. That's when rock and roll really started to grow up, I think. It started when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones started to co-opt these great American pioneers in soul. Much more than America ever did. And then when America sort of said, we got to appreciate what we got, that's when you started to hear American bands start integrating that. And Skinner was right there at the front.
Another thing you point out that I didn't realize is just how hard Skinner worked. And by your cover, I thought, okay, whiskey bottles and brand new cars, the fast life and sudden death of Lynyrd Skynyrd. We visit with Mark Grabowski, and that's the name of the book, and it is available from Chicago Review Press. It is a great read. It really is. There's so much great stuff in here. One of the misconceptions I had about this band was that you were going to tell me a bunch of stories about debauchery, which you did. And you were going to tell me a bunch of stories about guys blowing their money, which you did. But early on, during their ascent, there was a lot of hard work. There was a lot of, let's lock ourselves in this shed and play till our fingers bleed, so that when we get in front of people, we will be the real deal. Isn't that really what this band did?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the way it always begins? You know, it always begins with money, the last thing on your mind. Somebody like the Eagles, who were put together just to make money. I'm not doubting their art, but their genesis was completely different than bands like Skynyrd, who began as kids, began as high schoolers, learning how to put their art together as a unit, which is why they hung together as a unit. People would always remark, Al Cooper and other people would always remark when they came into this Skynyrd culture, how linked these people were. They could almost speak for each other. They could almost know what they were thinking. That's why they fought with each other so much. Now, Ronnie would come around a corner, and it was called creeping you. He would just slam you. He would hit you with a right hook and knock out a few teeth. Because that's what he did as a kid, and that's what these other guys did as a kid. They would fight with each other. So they had these raging fights in the studio even, right? Organic, if you want to even put it that way, because they came from the concrete and the soil of Jacksonville. That's what they were. And they never left Jacksonville. They never moved to L.A. They could have.
Nope.
They never moved to Nashville or Memphis. They could have. You know, they lived and they're all going to die, basically, as Southern boys. That was what they knew they had to feel out. They had to, you know, make this into art because it hadn't been done before that way. Southern people like that had always been denigrated by the Northern bosses of the record industry. They always denigrated people like that as hillbillies and rednecks going back to Hank Williams' time. They wouldn't even call it country and western music in Billboard. They would call it folk or hillbilly music. And that was the kind of prejudice that Ronnie always hated and resolved to change.